You're listening to Audio Journal. Up next are articles and stories from Reader's Digest. This program is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is Holly Miller, and I'm your volunteer reader. I'm recording this program from my home in Burney, Texas. I was a volunteer for Audio Journal when I lived in Massachusetts. I've since moved back to my home state of Texas, but I'm thrilled that I can continue volunteering for Audio Journal by recording this program remotely. I'll begin my program today with Dear Reader, thoughts from Content Director Jody L. Rolina, A New Virtual Reality. I'll admit it, I wasn't among the first to adopt AI. I'm a journalist, after all, and I have some ethical concerns about how the technology slurps up written works to create its large language models without credit or compensation for the writers, then in many cases renders those people and their roles obsolete. But the first time I tried using an AI assistant, I was blown away. In a company-wide meeting, one of the presenters used some financial jargon I didn't understand, so I typed his words verbatim into ChatGPT. In seconds, I had a layman's translation. It all made sense. Wherever you are with AI, whether you're all in, attempting to avoid it, or somewhere in between, we have intel for you. Start with making friends with AI, where you'll learn tips for using it wisely and avoiding its pitfalls. Read how AI is saving lives, and see how brilliant medical minds are using AI assist to come up with new cures. Then find out just how embedded the technology is in almost everything we do. In Could He Avoid AI for 2 Whole Days? Could he? Could you? As we're in the bloom of spring, you'll find nods to nature and green living across the issue. Meet a champion for native plants and everyday heroes. Learn about repair cafes, volunteer-staffed events where you can get broken stuff fixed for free, and find out about a fun way goats help humans. We have a surprise for you as we celebrate America's 250th birthday, a special parody of RD from July 1776. Enjoy life in these 13 colonies and more. Speaking of celebrating, you can help us start to plan our Nicest Places in America issue. We have big plans for our 10th year, and you can be a part of it. Contact us at letters@rd.com. Everyday heroes, nature's guardian. In the battle against invasive species, Alabama's native plants have an ally. By Katrin Einhorn. Nerding out on native plants may not seem like a formula for success as a social media influencer, but meet Kyle Liebarger. Born and raised in Alabama, often wearing camo, Liebarger has found unexpected internet fame by introducing his followers to the overlooked world of southeastern flora. Along the way, he has become a guardian, sometimes official, sometimes not, of a growing patchwork of rare and endangered plant populations across northern Alabama and beyond. A lot of what we're doing is saving these remnants so they still exist if people want to bring them back in the future, says Liebarger. In a state where more than 90% of the land is privately owned, that has meant knocking on doors to speak with landowners, who are unknowing hosts to rare plants. Liebarger, a forester by training, offers to care for those populations at no cost, thanks to his income from social media. On TikTok alone, he has almost 500,000 followers. Kyle figured out some secret sauce that immediately carried like wildfire across the nation, says Dwayne Estes, a professor of biology at Austin Peay State University and executive director of its Southeastern Grassland Institute. It's an incredible success story in American conservation. When pressed, Liebarger attributes his social media success to stubbornness, to a positive energy he inherited from his late dad, and largely to not worry about what others think. I was a deer hunter, forester, southern man posting about flowers, he says. You have to not really give a crap about what people think of you if you do that. It all started with what Liebarger now recognizes as a terrible mistake. About a decade ago, he was managing a private forest where the owner let him hunt, and he wanted to attract more deer and wild turkey. The land included an open rocky area, which he decided would be a good place to plant food for wildlife. He sprayed it with an herbicide, added soil, put down a feed mix, and cut down some trees to let in more light. In the dry, shallow soil, the seeds didn't take, but around the edges of the glade, where he hadn't sprayed or seeded, the additional sunlight unleashed a beautiful surprise. I came back up the next summer, and it was just like color everywhere, says Liebarger. Just like really, really crazy-looking plants that I saw. And I was like, I feel like I should know what this plant is. Now, of course, he can name them. The bright orange clusters are butterfly weed. The elegant purple spikes are blazing star. The Susian silhouettes were rattlesnake master. After he posted photos of the flowers on Facebook, a local botanist and science teacher named Kevin England got in touch. On a visit to the glade, Liebarger marveled as England pointed out rare and vulnerable species, such as Alabama larkspur. Liebarger realized that he had killed off an area with a wild seed bank of countless species that were ideal for attracting wildlife, all in order to plant two or three species that weren't part of the native ecosystem. That's kind of when the light bulb went off in my head that managing for biodiversity and what's supposed to be there is probably the best option. He dived into the body of research indicating that before European colonization, the Southeast was home to expansive grasslands in addition to forests. Over the centuries, fire suppression and other factors allowed the forests to dominate areas that were once savannas. Liebarger found a mission to save the remnants of those grasslands. And so one morning last spring found him chatting with Pat Eaton, who has a patch of endangered fleshy fruit gladcress growing near a pond on her family's property. Worldwide, the plant grows in only two Alabama counties, in fewer than 10 known populations, only one of them on public land, according to Al Schatz, a botanist at Auburn University and the state's Natural Heritage Program. It could disappear in a heartbeat, and we have quite a few others that fall into the same category, Schott says. Private landowners, they'll be the cornerstone of conservation for a lot of these plants, because state and federal agencies, they just don't have the funding to acquire every parcel of land with a very rare species. Near the patch on Eaton's property, a long strip of dead grass showed where someone had sprayed herbicide along the road. Liebarger asked Eaton if it would be okay to hang a sign instructing people not to mow or spray. Absolutely, she replied. A few miles away, Liebarger pointed out another federally endangered species, leafy prairie clover, that his social media followers have been instrumental in protecting. In 2023, he partnered with an artisan to design a t-shirt featuring the plant, hoping to raise awareness and help pay for conservation efforts. Then, he says, he found out that some of the timberland where the wild populations grew was for sale. We ended up raising over $100,000 just from t-shirts, Liebarger says. He used most of it to purchase the 24 acres that had been put up for sale, which he has pledged to put into a land trust or conservation easement. The remaining $20,000 or so will go towards similar projects in the future, he says. But he thinks his biggest contribution comes through education on social media, influencing people to grow the native plants that best support declining pollinators and other insects. One person, one yard, one-tenth of an acre can make a bigger difference than you think, he says. Miracle. Missing mom. A grieving daughter finds unmistakable signs on a walk around her neighborhood. By Celeste McCauley. And this is from Angels on Earth. It was the last thing I wanted to do. walk around my Brooklyn neighborhood on a hot and sticky July afternoon in search of a floor fan. The air conditioning in my apartment had just conked out, and who knew when the super would get around to having it fixed? I was in no mood for any of it. In truth, it was far more than the scorching sun that had me upset. The one-year anniversary of my mother's death was approaching, and I didn't know how I was going to handle it. She had died suddenly, after a late-stage cancer diagnosis. There'd been no time to prepare myself, if that was even possible. And over the past year, I'd only begun to take in the reality that I'd never feel her close again. She had visited me often from Pennsylvania, always emerging from the bus in a colorful outfit, accessorized to the hilt, ready to see the latest Broadway play or try the newest Italian place in Brooklyn. We never missed the lit-up Christmas tree at New York City's Rockefeller Center. She'd be in one of her mini Christmas sweaters, raring to go, suggesting that I add an extra layer against the cold, or demanding at least a warm hat, Celeste, before we left the apartment, just as she had when I went out to play in the snow as a kid. I passed the last cafe we'd sat in together. She would have surely asked me if I'd applied sunscreen before going out today. I could almost hear her questioning me. I walked by a row of brick walk-ups and noticed a sweater neatly draped over the gate out front, a signal that the gently used item was there for the taking. I wasn't sure who else would look twice at a Christmas sweater on such a hot day, but I did, knowing that Mom would have gotten a chuckle out of the bells and gift boxes adorning that sweater, putting it over the top even for her. Underneath the sweater, leaning against the gate, was a Touched by an Angel DVD. Roma Downey and Della Reese's classic was one of Mom's favorite TV shows. Was an angel trying to tell me something? I reached the corner and out of nowhere a woman called out to me. "Where's your hat?" she asked. She was in her 70s, impeccably dressed, with a jaunty straw hat to match her outfit. As she approached, I admired her earring and necklace set, a perfect summer ensemble, just like Mom would have worn. "Where's your hat, young lady?" the woman asked again. "That sun demands a hat." Martha introduced herself, and we exchanged pleasantries. She said she lived nearby. I didn't mention my broken air conditioning, my hunt for a fan, or that she was yet another answer to my prayer to feel Mom close. My neighborhood was full of memories and angels that did just that. 13 Things, Living History by Jacopo della Quisseria. 1. In April, the battles of Lexington and Concord will be fought all over again, as they are every year in the Massachusetts towns where the first shots of the American Revolution rang out. Bringing the past to life tends to be a lifelong hobby, says reenactor Edward Heinrichs, director of the Herkimer Home State Historic Site in upstate New York. It takes years to perfect your knowledge, and it becomes a lifestyle. 2. Veterans of our Revolutionary War may have been its first reenactors. That's because soldiers in the Continental Army used to stage sham fights, mock battles without musket balls, when generals reviewed them. This continued even after the war in towns like Bennington, Vermont, which held commemorative sham fights in 1789 and 1802. 3. Reenactments of history are almost as old as history itself. In ancient Rome, Julius Caesar staged skirmishes featuring horses, elephants, and warships. And while they fought under false pretenses, the prisoners forced to take part in these spectacles died very real deaths. As the Roman Empire grew, so did these displays. A mock naval battle held in A.D. 52 involved more than 19,000 men. 4. Renaissance fairs are among the most popular historical reenactments nowadays. One of the biggest in the United States is the Texas Renaissance Festival, which attracts more than 500,000 guests each year. And while some fairgoers think the turkey legs taste suspiciously like ham, they are in fact turkey meat that gets cured and smoked as ham is today. The cooking method is accurate to the time period, the meat, not so much. As a New World bird, turkey wasn't on the menu in medieval Europe. 5. It was a California couple who put on the first modern Renaissance fair in 1963. Phyllis and Ron Patterson recreated an Elizabethan celebration in their backyard, and though they strove for historical accuracy, not everything was perfect. I remember a young girl running up to me, Phyllis Patterson told the Los Angeles Times in 1987, and saying, "You've got to do something. Someone back there's playing Bach." 6. A drone literally flew in the face of medieval reenactors in Lipetsk, Russia, in 2016. In response, a knight launched his spear and took down the offending gadget. The drone was meant to capture footage of the festival, but instead, it caught this dramatic moment, which then went viral. 7. No newfangled doodads are allowed at any reenactment put on by the Vikings of North America. The organization's website warns, "We disallow modern items that would break the spell." But a similar group in the UK, called the Vikings, advertise their availability for anything that falls within our dateline, 700 CE to 1100 CE, including film work. 8. Anachronism aside, taking part in reenactments is probably the best way you can learn about history, says Heinrichs. While reenactors are often teachers, veterans, or history buffs, anyone can take part, though most groups ask that you be at least in your late teens to fight alongside them. 9. Maybe the most famous Civil War reenactment was at the 1913 Gettysburg Reunion, when more than 50,000 veterans of that war set up camp in the Pennsylvania town for the 50th anniversary of its famous battle. This November, a Lincoln impersonator will visit the battlefield and give the Gettysburg Address. 10. Each summer, a World War II reenactment in Conneaut, Ohio, draws about 1,500 reenactors and 45,000 spectators to a stretch of Lake Erie that resembles Omaha Beach, one of the five beaches in Normandy, France, where Allied forces overwhelmed the Nazis and began to liberate Western Europe. The Ohio event started in 1999 and is now one of the country's largest D-Day reenactments. 11. The best way to become a reenactor is to find a group or unit that you like, according to YouTuber Chris the Redcoat, because large events are often made up of smaller circles of friends. Chris answers common questions he gets about reenacting in one of his videos. Another reenactor, Brandon Frischella, reveals some of the strangest questions he's fielded. "I've been asked if I was North or South," he says, in a World War II reenactment. 12. Most serious reenactors wear kilts, not costumes. These museum-worthy pieces are usually handmade, so they take a long time to assemble. But they are labors of love. As Samantha Graves Brunell, a soldier with the 2nd Continental Artillery Reenactment Group out of Albany, New York, says, "You're working to be as authentic as you can. Even my eyeglasses have to be specific." And finally, 13. But you don't have to adopt a whole new wardrobe to embrace history. As we celebrate the 250th anniversary of the United States this year, you might want to throw tea into the Boston Harbor at the Boston Tea Party Ship and Museum, or listen to the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. To learn more about these and other related events, visit America250.org, the website of the U.S. Semiquincentennial Commission. Its aim? To inspire us all to reflect on our past and renew our commitment to the ideals of democracy. Life in these United States. From Nan Bogason. I'm short and stout, so buying attractive clothes can be something of an adventure. But a friend of mine gave it her best shot when she bought me a gorgeous white dress as a present. I happily tried it on and modeled it for my brother. "Well, what do you think?" I asked. He gave me the once-over and answered, "You look like a gallon of milk," from Bill Henderson. During breakfast, my friend's young daughter asked the question all parents dread. "Are you the Easter Bunny?" Looking confused, she followed up with, "I mean, how would you get into everybody's house?" From Blair Imani on Threads. Scene. My dad offering 8-year-old me a handful of walnuts. Me. "I can't have those. I'm allergic." Dad. "What will happen?" Me. "They make my mouth itch." Dad. "That's just what walnuts do." And that's when my dad learned that he's allergic to walnuts. From Erica Next Door on X. When people give me directions and say, "You can't miss it," I'm like, "Oh, you do not know what I am capable of." From BoardPanda.com. Sometimes the best material on YouTube can be found in the comments section. If idiots could fly, TikTok would be an airport. Surgery is just stabbing someone to life. Regarding Disney's Snow White, if I saw this movie on a plane, I would still walk out. From GCFL.net, I was very pregnant when just days before my due date, my husband fell from the porch roof, sprained both ankles, and was restricted to crutches. When I went into labor and he couldn't drive, I took the wheel, stopping every time I had a contraction. Finally, we got to the hospital. I dropped him off at the maternity entrance, and he hobbled off to the admitting desk, where the nurse told him to go to the emergency room. "No, it's my wife," he said breathlessly. "She's in labor." "Where is she?" the nurse asked. "She's parking the car and bringing in the bags." From Gina Ferella Howley. A friend told me that her grandmother had a habit of ending emails and texts with WTF. Since it was out of character for her to curse, my friend asked her, "Grandma, what do you think WTF stands for?" Amused that she would have to explain anything techie to her granddaughters, she replied, "It means wasn't that funny." Glad to hear it. Three stories to make your day. In Stitches, comedian Drew Lynch was doing stand-up at a comedy club in Spokane, Washington last September when a man in the crowd collapsed from cardiac arrest. Other audience members performed CPR until medics arrived and took the man, Dick Winday, 83, to a nearby hospital. A shaken-up Lynch finished his set but couldn't get the man out of his mind. So the next day, he visited Winday in the hospital to tell him the jokes he hadn't gotten to hear, spending hours at his bedside. This was a delight for Winday, a longtime fan of Lynch. And from that day on, the two stayed in touch, texting often. Lynch visited Winday again months later, and when Winday passed away on January 7th, Lynch wrote on Facebook, "I will miss our friendship," signing the post, "Your foster grandson, Drew." Keeping his head above water, 12-year-old Ashish Selvaraj was riding in the car with his nanny and her 2-year-old son last summer in Montgomery County, Maryland, when a flash flood swept their vehicle off the road and into an overflowing creek bed. As water rushed around them, the quick-thinking tween grabbed the toddler and climbed on top of the car, allowing the young child to breathe and rescue crews to see where they were. The car was totally submerged and practically invisible in the deluge by the time firefighters reached them. After bringing all three of them back to dry land, the firefighters called Ashish a hero. His parents felt so grateful to the first responders that they showed up at the firehouse days later with a check for $10,000. And finally, a special arrangement. The somber notes of Taps are played at every funeral that includes military honors. But those notes often emerge from a device played on an official recording instead of in front of a live instrument. Two nationwide nonprofits, Bugles Across America and Taps for Veterans, match volunteer horn players with events that could use their services. Matthew Burford is one such volunteer, and he has driven more than 100 miles from his home in Alabama to play Taps live. "It's not like I don't like the recording," Burford told the New York Times. "I just feel like our veterans and our soldiers deserve better." From Nature, Moose Alert by John Garrity. There are hundreds of moose, grizzly bears, and black bears in Alaska's Denali National Park. But given that the park covers 9,492 square miles, the likelihood of encountering a moose or bear is pretty low, according to the National Park Service. The sparse distribution isn't a result of hunting or disease. It just takes a lot of land to provide enough food and habitat for such massive animals. "I'm with my family on a summer vacation, taking a roughly 40-mile bus tour into Denali National Park. The scenery is spectacular, and as our guide suggests, maybe it's just as well not to get our hopes up about seeing a moose or bear, because our visit has coincided with the time of year that those animals are typically in an aggressive mood. Apparently, the bears like to eat moose calves, and right around early June, the surviving calves become fast enough to evade the bears, leaving the bears hungry. Moose mothers, having lost a significant portion of their young, can also be bad-tempered by the time June rolls around. Moose aren't carnivorous, but they'll charge at, kick, or stomp anything they deem a threat. If you encounter a bear, you have several self-preservation options. Try to make yourself as big as possible. Create a lot of noise or play dead. With a threatening moose, the advice from Alaska Department of Fish and Game is run and get behind something solid like a tree. Believe it or not, the Fish and Game Department warns that more people in the state are injured by moose than by bears each year. In Alaska, moose outnumber bears 3-1, and they injure between 5 and 10 people annually, mostly in vehicle accidents. That's more than grizzly bear and black bear attacks combined. Thankfully, most people have the good sense to keep away from bears. My wife and two teenagers are itching to get out and experience stretches of Denali on foot, so we get off the bus. We're about two-thirds of the way up the Mount Healy Overlook Trail when my younger teenager announces he needs to relieve himself. I figure I'd better not let him get out of sight, not a matter of precaution so much as thinking it's best to keep an eye on anyone who goes off trail in the wild. The ground is soft and spongy because of the permafrost, absorbing the sound of footsteps. And then, a few moments after my son begins his business, I see it, about 40 feet away, and moseying in our direction. A moose. It has no antlers, so it looks like a black stallion on a rigorous steroid regime. We are no more than 20 feet off the trail, have been off it for barely a minute, and despite the long odds, have just run into wildlife that absolutely dwarfs me. And I'm 6'2". It doesn't seem agitated or angry, but I'm not a moose psychologist. Now, before our guide's moose awareness talk, I would have been more fascinated than worried, and probably cracking Bullwinkle jokes. But now I know my family and I are having a close encounter with an animal that our guide, someone who has also run into grizzly bears several times, seems genuinely worried about. I call out to my family, my voice about one octave higher than usual. It's less primal fear than a sudden intense realization that I cannot control what happens next, and the odds of an angry moose incident are suddenly greater than zero. My son and I retreat to the trail. Our massive moose friend comes out too, and then turns down the trail, headed toward the four of us. It doesn't seem angry, but it's clearly aware and not the least bit intimidated. My older teenager urges everyone to back away slowly and quietly. We retreat a bit more, and the moose advances a bit more. Remembering the hide behind a tree advice, we retreat into the woods. The mosquitoes are thrilled at the arrival of a four-person blood buffet. We peek out. The moose is still there, still moving slowly in our direction. We retreat deeper into the woods, standing back to back. After a few minutes of the mosquitoes dining like kings, our hearts pounding, and adrenaline pumping, the moose loses interest and wanders off. We return to the trail, encountering some bikers coming down the way we were headed. Excited, we say, "Did you guys see the moose?" "What moose?" "Good thing I took a photo. Otherwise, no one would believe us." Did you know that there are many ways to listen to Audio Journal broadcasts? You can listen to our live stream from your computer or tablet simply by going to our website at audiojournal.org. With a Wi-Fi connection, Audio Journal can also be accessed through your smart speaker. Simply say, "Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn," or "Hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn." You can also listen using a landline phone. For phone access, call Zeno Media at 1-712-770-1043. We also provide special receivers tuned to Audio Journal's frequency. Need one? Give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org for more information. You can also listen through local cable TV stations. Check our list to find your town by going to audiojournal.org/ways-2-listen. Oh no! Did you miss your favorite program? Not a problem. Look for archives on our website or the Audio Journal iPhone app at audiojournal.org/podcast-archive. Audio Journal is located at 799 West Boylston Street in Worcester. You can reach us at 508-797-1117 or at info@audiojournal.org. Sports, bigger than the game. In sports, some wins mean more than the final score. Fans picked up the football. Sure, a Super Bowl run was fun, but donating to their rival's cause meant even more. By Victor Mather, and this is from the New York Times. When a player on the opposing team makes a terrible mistake on a big play, the reaction for many sports fans is joy. Our team's going to win. We rule. You stink. But not every sports fan. With a minute and a half left in an NFL playoff game last season, the Baltimore Ravens had scored a touchdown to close their deficit to the Buffalo Bills, bringing the score to 27-25. A two-point conversion would tie the game. "The whole season essentially comes down to this play," says the play-by-play TV announcer Jim Nance. The Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson threw the ball to tight end Mark Andrews, who was on the goal line. He caught it, and he dropped it. To be fair, he seemed to slip as the ball reached him in the snowy field in Buffalo, New York, but he dropped it. The whole season did come down to that play, and the Ravens blew it and lost the game. Their season was over. But at least some Bills fans felt sympathy, even amid their triumph. Andrews has type 1 diabetes, and two Bills fans set out to raise money for Breakthrough T1D, a charity supporting diabetes research and advocacy that he has supported. Their language sounds just a little different from the fiery speech some football fans like to use when discussing the game. "We just want to spread love. That's really what we want to do," says lifelong Bills fan Ryan Patoda, now a junior at Canisius University in Buffalo. He and a classmate, Nicholas Howard, run an Instagram page for Bills fans, and they decided to start a charitable drive with that goal in mind. "I mean, honestly, you hate the other team," Patoda says. "You want your team to win. But we want to bring both bases together and say, hey, this is more than a game." Howard says, "I've got a tremendous respect for Mark Andrews, even though he was playing against us." Their efforts have raised more than $146,000 from 4,000-plus donations. The original goal was to raise $5,000. "I never expected it to blow up like this," Patoda says. Initially, donations were mostly from Bills fans, but as word spread, fans of the Ravens and other NFL teams joined in. Andrews pricks his fingers 30 times a game to check his blood sugar and uses an insulin pump. Type 1 diabetes is challenging, but I refuse to let it affect my job or my life in any way, he said in an article posted on the website of the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School. It's impossible to adequately express how I feel, Andrews said on social media a few days after the game. I'm absolutely gutted by what happened on Sunday. I'm devastated for my teammates, my coaches, and Ravens fans. He added, despite the negativity, I've seen heartfelt love and encouragement, including from those who have generously donated to the Breakthrough T1D organization. Patota says he remains a staunch Bills fan, but going forward, he adds, we're definitely going to have a soft spot for the Ravens. A boy's big decision. It was a dream come true, but the young baseball fan had another idea. By Bill Hangley Jr. Donna Morey and Jameson Pennings both had a feeling this would be a special day at the ballpark. They both got what they wanted, plus a whole lot more. He renewed my faith in humanity, Morey says. It felt really, really good, says Jameson. Jameson was there to achieve a major goal in his 9-year-old life, getting a foul ball at a baseball game. Morey was there to celebrate her 80th birthday with her family. In the end, Jameson got not one, but two balls, and Morey got a birthday present she'd never expected. A foul ball from Jameson, a young man she'd never met before. For the first time in a long time, I was at a loss for words, she says. It all happened one day last September at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia, where the Phillies were squaring off against the New York Mets. Morey and Jameson were both sitting close to the field, a few rows from each other, right by the spot where ball girls often toss foul balls into the crowd. Jameson was there with his father, James Pennings. The family had splurged on pricey seats just so Jameson could have a shot at snagging a ball. He had his mitt and his Phillies jersey. He was ready. On a scale of 1 to 10, how badly did he want that ball? Really, really badly, he says. 9.5. Meanwhile, Morey's family sat with her a few rows away, hoping that their mom could get a ball too. My daughters take me to a Phillies game every year, but this time was special because it was my 80th birthday, Morey says. They went all out and got my name and age up on the scoreboard, which I wanted to kill them for. In the fifth inning, Jameson's dream came true. A Mets player rolled a stray ball to the ball girl, and she handed it past the net to Jameson. Success. For a few innings, he sat cradling the ball in his mitt. But then in the seventh inning, he heard something he couldn't ignore. Morey's daughter Joanne came up to the ball girl and made a special request. She said, "Can I get a ball for my mom? It's her 80th birthday," Jameson recalls. The wheels began turning in the young man's head. He's got grandparents. He knows that somebody who's 80 might not get that many more chances to get a ball. Since he was little, he's had that heart of gold, said his mother, Eve Torres Pennings. He's always been conscious about how he can include people, make sure they're not left out. So Jameson told himself, if she doesn't get the next ball, I'll give her mine. By now the game was almost over, and still no ball for Morey. Jameson knew that his moment had come. I put my head down for a few seconds. It felt like a while. But my dad said it was just a few seconds, says Jameson. I was just phasing between I have to and never mind. It just swept through me. Silently, he made his decision. Then Jameson turned to his father. I want to give that lady my ball, he says. James was shocked. Are you sure? Jameson said he was. So together they got up, and Jameson led the way to Morey's seat. What Morey remembers is watching a batter, then feeling her daughter tap her on the arm and hearing her say, "This little boy wants to give you something." Morey looked up and saw Jameson. He's got the cutest expression on his face. Just kindness, she recalls. He says, I want to give you my foul ball. She was deeply moved. She's got 4 kids and 9 grandchildren. She knows what a baseball means to a 9-year-old. So she thanked him and his father while her family cheered. The Phillies ball girl saw it all, and she made sure Jameson got another ball. Today, Maury's ball sits by the picture of her grandkids, reminding her every day of Jameson's simple act of kindness. In Jameson's house, the second ball sits in his room, signed by Maury and her daughter, reminding him that he made the right decision. Jameson is certain that he did. It's just destiny for her to get a ball, he says. She's been coming to games for 50 years. True champions. Why, these high school hoopers gave their trophy to the other team, by Caroline Fanning. The players on the girls' basketball team at the Academy of Cassatius Christian Studies in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, knew something wasn't right. Their coach, Brandon King, never contacted them on a Sunday, but on this Sunday, he said he needed them back at the gym. Many players arrived straight from church, still elated from their championship win the night before, but now jittery. The score had been miscounted on last night's 44-43 win, he told them. Academy had actually lost to their opponent from Apache High School, 43-42. That doesn't take away how proud I am of you guys and how hard we worked to get here, King assured them. Still, it was a bitter pill to swallow. Players asked questions. Was he sure? What did this mean for the rest of their tournament? Together, they debated next steps. Policy states that once the game is finished, it's finished. There's no overturning the final score. But within 20 minutes, the team decided there was only one thing left to do. Turn the trophy over to the rightful champions, Apache. There wasn't really any hesitation in our minds, team co-captain Sydney Kitchen told the New York Times. The district championship game against Apache was physical and intense. The Academy players were the underdogs, and King knew they'd have to play their absolute best for a chance at winning. Scoring was back and forth until the fourth quarter, when Apache pulled away by 14 points with 4 minutes on the clock. King was considering emptying the bench when he called one last timeout. If we want to make one final push to win this game, this is the time to do it, he told his players. Academy came out of the timeout with new energy, playing as if they had nothing to lose, sinking shot after shot to pull within a few points of Apache. Then, with 2 minutes left to go, the referee blew the whistle, stopping play in its tracks. There was a discrepancy between the scoreboard and scorebook. The scoreboard had Academy down by 4 points. The scorebook had them down by 2. League rules state that the score defaults to the scorebook. The scoreboard was updated to 43-41 Apache. Play resumed. Academy freshman Lily Payne hit a 3-point buzzer beater to top Apache by a point for the school's first ever district championship. The home crowd rushed the court as players dogpiled on top of one another. But King walked to the locker room with a sinking feeling in his gut. I was like, I need to know if we won that game or not, just for my peace of mind, he says. That night, King sat down at his kitchen table with the game tape. He watched the entire thing through, tallying every point on a notepad. His gut, it turned out, was right. By his account, Academy had lost the game by a point. He watched a second time to be sure. With 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter, just a minute before the referee stopped the game, an Academy shot went up and rolled dubiously around the rim. The crowd roared, sure that it was bound to drop into the basket, but then it didn't. Instead, it came down for a rebound. King suspects that the record keeper had a poor angle and thought it had gone in. At 1 a.m., deflated, but relieved to know the truth, King went to bed. When he got up in the morning, he alerted the athletic director and the league's governing body. Then he told the players to meet him at school and broke the news. Next, with the team's support, King made the 90-minute drive to Apache to deliver the trophy to its players. He didn't have to do that, Apache coach Amy Merriweather told the Times. Most coaches wouldn't have. Merriweather had also noticed the error and raised the issue with officials, who had informed her that the score couldn't be overturned. But after reviewing King's report, they made an exception, earning Apache its win on paper, too. I handed them the trophy and told them there was no ill will, and we'd never do this for any crazy reason, says King. They worked just as hard as we did, and I hated that the moment was taken away from them and their families and friends. After King handed over the trophy to them in the gym, the Apache players recreated what would have been the game-winning shot from senior Tatum Howlingwater. This time, she celebrated with the trophy, tagging it. A wrestling coach helps a team member's dad win at life, by Shannon Scovell. And this is from NCAA.com. Sam Latona, a two-time NCAA All-American wrestler for the Virginia Tech Hokies, remembers getting the call from his family with the news that his father was sick. It was January 2022, and the team was traveling back to their campus in Blacksburg, Virginia after a meet. His dad, Norm Latona, was in kidney failure. Norm's treatment started with in-home dialysis, where a tube was inserted to his belly to flush it and function as his kidney. It worked for about a year, but then his condition declined. He was diagnosed with pneumonia. But that, Sam says, was one of the scariest moments for the family. Sam's brother Dom Latona had also wrestled at Virginia Tech. Now, Dom was in medical school, and he was able to explain the intricacies of the situation to Sam. I remember having conversations with my mom and my brother, just like, what do we have to do? And kind of crying to each other, says Sam. But at the end of the day, we had each other's backs, and we were there for each other. Norm, who lives in Alabaster, Alabama, had to go into a dialysis clinic several times a week for hours at a time to clean out his kidneys. Still, the proud dad kept traveling to watch Sam, finding treatment centers in each city. He spent as much time as he could in Blacksburg, too, for Sam's home meets. I didn't want to miss anything, Norm says. I would come on a Thursday to Blacksburg so I could do a treatment Friday morning. And then he'd watch his son wrestle on Friday night. Blacksburg is not a bad place to spend a couple of days every other week, he says. The head wrestling coach of the Hokies, Tony Robbie, had been following Norm's condition. As Norm struggled and ultimately needed a kidney transplant, Robbie felt called to help. And so last May, the Hokies announced that Norm had undergone a kidney transplant following prolonged health troubles. The donor? The wrestling coach, Tony Robbie. Fortunately for Norm, the transplant marked the end of a tumultuous and emotional 3-year journey. With the help of the selfless act from Robbie, Norm is now healthy again. Sam describes it as a pretty incredible, very surreal medical miracle. Norm had become a good friend over the last several years, so that played a huge role in this, says Robbie. My relationship with him and the kind of person that he is made this an easy decision. Robbie says he had a feeling that he was going to be a match to donate a kidney to Norm. This was all part of God's plan and what he wanted me to do. I just had faith in that, says Robbie. After blood work and a series of rigorous medical tests, it was confirmed. Robbie was indeed a match. Sam describes Robbie as not a very emotional guy, but says Robbie gave him a hug and told him how much he loved him as they talked through the decision last January. Months passed. The anticipation of the surgery was on everyone's mind, but Robbie told Sam to focus on wrestling. He was like, I don't want this to change anything about the way that you compete. I don't want you to think anything of it. I want you to just continue to wrestle the way that you are and continue to do the sport that you love, Sam says. Sam kept winning until the NCAA Nationals in Philadelphia last March, where he lost in the first round. In early May, he and Robbie went together to Alabama for the operation. On the big day, everyone headed to the hospital around 5 a.m. First came Robbie's procedure to remove one of the kidneys for the transplant. Hours passed. The families, especially his wife, Jennifer Robbie, started to get anxious. By 10 a.m., the doctors came out to update her. They called her over and said, "Finally, hey, we got the kidney out. It's going into Mr. Latona," Sam says. 15 minutes later, Tony Robbie's kidney was in Norm Latona's body, supporting his medical needs. The success still wows Sam. "It's almost crazy from a medical standpoint. How is this even possible? Someone else's kidney is in my dad," he says. Their journey in Blacksburg isn't over either. Sam is now a recruiting coordinator for the Hokies, representing the team where he competed and also working with the man who helped save his father's life. Says a grateful Sam, "Coach Robbie deserves all the credit for the person that he is and the things that he's done. He's an incredible human being and an awesome person." All in a day's work. From Roger Anderson. In my new supervisory position, I noticed that one of my director's reports wasn't meeting job expectations. In his first year, he had already received 2 professional improvement plans, or PIPs. I asked the company president if there was a limit on how many PIPs one could receive. "There is," he said. "We use the Gladys Knight rule. 3 PIPs." From Anna Lynn Smith. A firefighter spoke to my sister-in-law's first grade class about fire safety. As an introduction to the concept of stop, drop, and roll, he asked the children, "What would you do if your clothes were on fire?" One little boy said, "I wouldn't put them on." From Reddit.com, these waiters couldn't wait to sound off on some of their more memorable customers. A guy pointed to the menu and asked, "These baby back ribs, are they fish ribs?" Customer asked if our milk comes from female cows. "Crab should taste like crabs, not shellfish." Watching a kid pump simple syrup into his hand thinking it was hand sanitizer. Had a guy who ordered eggs, sunny side down, and was very adamant about it. And finally, "What's the difference between duck and lamb?" From 6 Foot Candy on X. From Jonathan Frankel. During a job interview, the hiring manager asked me what my greatest weakness was. I panicked and blurted, "Donuts?" He stared at me. I stared at him. Finally, he nodded and said, "Same." From James Naren. My supervisor, Bill, was having trouble with groundhogs digging up his flower garden. Not wanting to harm them, he went to the local hardware store and rented 2 live traps. "What do I do with the groundhogs after I catch them?" he asked. The store owner said, "I tell everyone to take them west out of town until the road turns to gravel and let them go." Bill was appalled. "That's where I live." From Ramon Presson. While leading a lunch and learn CPR training for a law firm, I demonstrated chest compressions on our CPR dummy, which is just a head and chest with no arms and nothing below the chest. Partway through the demo, a paralegal commented, "Your efforts are certainly admirable, but with most of his body gone, even if he were to survive, I think you have to ask, what quality of life is he really going to have?" And the award goes to... The Nobel Prizes are serious awards bestowed upon those who have contributed to science, medicine, literature, peace, and economics. Presented by the magazine Annals of Improbable Research are non-serious prizes awarded to those whose research makes us scratch our heads. Here are the latest recipients. For literature, the late Dr. William B. Bean, American. For recording and analyzing the rate of growth of his fingernails over a period of 35 years. For nutrition, research from Nigeria, Italy, and France. For studying the extent to which a rainbow lizard chooses to eat certain kinds of pizza. For peace, researchers from the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, and Germany, for showing that drinking alcohol sometimes improves a person's ability to speak in a foreign language. and for engineering design. Researchers from India for analyzing how foul-smelling shoes affect the good experience of using a shoe rack. Best Pet Helpers, where dogs can't sniff, this otter dives in, by Caroline Fanning. Since last January, a new search and recovery team member has been in hot pursuit of missing persons in Southwest Florida's lakes, rivers, and bays. Splash, a 2-year-old otter, jumps in where dogs leave off as canine noses lose the trail at the water's edge. But an otter's unique underwater senses allow Splash to taste the bubbles in the water for a human scent. When he makes a discovery, he squeaks an alert to his handler, Michael Hadsell. An Asian small-clawed otter, Splash, is the first of his species to be used for search and recovery. Hadsell, who's worked with Peace Canine Search and Rescue's canine team for years, wondered, why can't an otter do this? He has trained Splash since the eager otter was 4 months old, fresh from the Wildlife World Zoo near Phoenix, Arizona. When Splash isn't working, he's home with Hadsell and the dogs, diving in the pool and snoozing on the couch. He gets a bath and a few days of rest to make sure he stays healthy. We call those union breaks, says Hadsell. From the South China Morning Post. You've heard the story of the tortoise and the hare. Well, a farm in China hosted an actual race between the two species to test whether the well-known tale would play out the same way in real life. The hare took an early lead, but soon got distracted and stopped, allowing the tortoise to catch up. The tortoise, meanwhile, maintained a slow, steady pace and eventually won the race. Well, that does it for our program today. You've been listening to Articles and Stories from Reader's Digest. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Holly Miller, and I'll be with you again soon. Thanks for listening.
This is Bird Note. When wildlife conservationist Olya Weekly was a little kid, she noticed something incredible from her apartment window.
I was born and raised in Ukraine, and we were living on the third floor, and in the corner of our window in the kitchen, every year, house martins came and made a mud nest.
House martins are a kind of swallow that breed across much of Europe. They construct an enclosed nest from mud and spit, often under the eaves of homes and city buildings.
And my grandma would be furious because they would just make a whole big mess on the glass. And she would grumble about it and be like, oh, these darn house martins. But at the same time, we both would be glued to them and watching the parents come and feed the babies and seeing the little yellow baby mouths sticking out. And then eventually we could see each one of them leave the nest and then we would wait for them to come back the next year.
Today in Arizona, Olya leads the Nest Box program at Tucson Bird Alliance, which designs nest boxes for desert birds and helps people create nesting opportunities at home.
It's super special to be able to sit and watch their behaviors in the nest box, on an open cup nest, even in the window of your third floor apartment.
For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
There are more than 1 million English words. Next up, word nerd Steph Donath with some of them worth talking about.
It's amazing how many of these words have to do with being drunk. According to drinkbusiness.com, a newsletter about the business of drinking, a new study by two German linguists has discovered that there are 546 words in the English language to describe being in a state of drunkenness. also known as soaked, skunked, snozzled, and squiffy. They range alphabetically from a drip, ankled, and annihilated to zoned and zonked, but they could not find any that began with the letters Q, U, V, X, or Y. And for reasons unknown, most begin with the letter B, 56 of them to be exact. And they range from befuddled, boiled, bonkers, and boogaloo to bottled, bumpsy, Berlin, Buffy, and buzzed. And what one single word is the opposite to all of them? Sober. I'll drink to that.
That's enough talk about words. Let's go back to listening to them.